Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for July 24th, 2022. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right. Well, it's a big show tonight coming on the podcast for the first time in, I guess, over a year, probably the longest break from the show, is our good friend from Public Policy Polling, Tom Jensen. He'll be coming on, and Tom has probably been one of our two most frequent guests in history. I think, Tim, you had done the math on that. So it's great to have Tom come back in, tell us a lot about polling from around the country, and so he'll be in here about 20 minutes. But until then, we're just going to kind of hit some smaller issues. Last week we did the big ranking of the Senate race, and one race that none of the three of us ranked but has gotten very interesting, but it's a very, you know, strange dynamic, to be honest, is Utah. And so I thought we'd start off there to kind of piggyback off of last week. In Utah, Mike Lee is running for re-election. Mike Lee, I think, is pretty controversial. He's probably not as known as a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley, but he's definitely cut from that cloth. He's running for re-election. Seemingly, the Democrats are not mounting a campaign against him because Evan McMullen, independent candidate, former Republican, who ran, you know, for president in 2016 because he was a never-Trumper, couldn't stomach Donald Trump, but I guess couldn't stomach the idea of voting for a Democrat either. He ran for president. Really, I think his impact was minimal, to say the least, but he's from Utah. So he's running, and right now the latest poll shows Mike Lee comfortably under 50, and I think it's a single-digit race, probably closer to 10 than 1, but a single-digit race. And this is pretty early in the campaign where people probably don't necessarily know the candidates. And so some, you know, Democratic leading voters in Utah, and yes, those do exist, one of the congressional districts in the state has been Democratic more than Republican in recent cycles. They may not even know, hey, the Democrats aren't fielding a candidate this time to even kind of make a decision on that race. So that race is much more in play than one would predict in the state of Utah. Catherine, what's your take on what's going on there with a Republican facing an independent?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it's really a Republican facing another Republican that decided to run as an independent. I think that it will indicate, you know, it'll be another indicator of, you know, Trump, of the support that Trump candidates have. So it'll be interesting to watch. And it's always, I find it refreshing to have independents in the Senate just for a, sort of evens the balance a little bit. It'd be interesting to see who he votes with if he's elected.
Yes. Tim, to me, I get the idea of Utah, and it is a very Mormon state, is a state where people are very personally conservative in the way they live their life, but yet they kind of follow the rules. They're kind of good government people and that kind of sense of, you know, if you've decided to do something, you're going to do it by the law and by the book. And what that creates is conservative-leaning voters that don't function like Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, that ilk, people that were involved in the insurrection. I have a feeling if you had a heat map, even though Utah's so Republican, there probably weren't as many people from Utah commensurate with their population. So that's kind of the dynamic I see out of the state. So in this kind of race, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, you know, the Mormon church runs that state. If you're not a Mormon in that state, you're nothing. And as far as how they vote, in, you know, Lyndon Johnson's the last Democrat to win that state in 1964, and that was in a blowout landslide type election. The compilation polling, and I think Nate Silver's bunch does it about as well as anybody. They got Lee ahead of McMullen, like 45.5 to 35.9, with like 14% divided between a couple of independents that are on the ballot, and then the rest is undecided. But some of the breakdowns of this latest polling, especially the one you were talking about, it shows McMullen getting 63% of Democrats. I believe that, but 28% of Republicans, 41% of independents. Lee only gets 57% of Republican voters, and he's the incumbent senator. I do know that Larry Sabato downgraded the race from safe Republican to likely Republican, and I think that's about where it stands right now. I still think he's going to win that race. He'll probably appeal to Republicans to basically get in line, to coalesce around him and remind them he's the Republican in the race. And although it'll be closer than a lot of races out there should be, I think he'll emerge with a win.
Yes, Catherine's a figure that I haven't heard if he's endorsed and gotten involved is Mitt Romney. Even though Mitt Romney is the junior senator. Yeah, so even though he's the junior senator from the state, he kind of has a much larger political profile. I certainly think that Mike Lee, probably even the governor, Spencer Cox. Tim, I guess we'll ask you the question, and then we can come back to Catherine for thoughts. Has Mitt Romney, as to you know, gotten involved in this race?
Not at all, and I'm not surprised that he hasn't. I don't think Lee would ask him unless Lee really thought that he was in trouble, because those two butt heads on too many things.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to the next question, and I will go back to Catherine for this. Catherine, in the end, do you think he gets involved, and do you think there's a chance he could possibly just throw caution to the wind and try to really, you know, get this, you know, for lack of a better word, maverick brand and endorsement mulling?
It doesn't sound like a Mitt Romney move to me. He's a little too cautious for that, in my opinion. I think he stays out of it.
Yeah, but even the fact that he stays out, he's not in for Lee, and I think that is an interesting development. Another issue I wonder how it's going to play is, I don't know how much y'all been following the water crisis out west, but Utah is one of those states that's significantly impacted. And since they're in the upper Colorado Basin, not the lower Colorado Basin, you know, and they have to worry about, you know, places like Phoenix and Las Vegas and Los Angeles having some of that water, they're kind of seeing what they can do to curtail water usage in Utah. So this is kind of front and center for citizens of Utah. Mike Lee, from my recollection of past positions, is no friend of, you know, saving the climate and changing course to do anything different. Could Utah voters because this issue is facing them probably in a more direct way than it is a lot of other states, could it play an outsized impact in this race if Evan McMullen has real solutions and really talks about this in a realistic way, Tim?
It could be the third most important issue there, I would think. But I still think inflation and the economy is going to supersede
yeah.
it. I still think those two issues are going to be front and center, and that's where Lee is going to be on the right side of things, because he's going to be running against Biden, who he says will, you know, be the author of all evils. So, while it might help McMullen a little bit, I certainly don't think it could propel him to a win or anything like that.
Yeah, and the sad and ironic thing, I think, here is water usage where the river runs through your state. If the snow comes and melts out of your mountains, and other states, of course, too, you can have a real impact on that. You know, what the price of oil is coming in from Saudi Arabia, or if Russia cuts their oil off. American politicians have, you know, limited resources and what they can do. In water usage, you can really impact that, yet people may very well vote on, supply chains from China and oil prices from the Middle East, and then make that the third issue in a state like Utah. And that is a sad state of affairs when people could, you know, actually vote on things that politicians would have a more direct impact on. Also, some places, if you have certain industries, the water usage is more important than the gasoline in many ways. It depends on, you know, if you're farming there, if you're having recreational vehicles, you know, on some of those lakes and rivers, it impacts you more than the gas. Catherine, do you want to make a point?
No, I was just agreeing with you. I mean, water is the next big, going to be the next big battle, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the one that's going to be very tangible. We're going to see it right off. I mean, you know, if pollination patterns, get disrupted and there's less fruits and vegetables and then prices go up, people are going to once again have this nebulous discussion of inflation where they just blame whoever's in charge,
but
not understanding
what goes
into that underneath. Where's water?
But David, you know, the people of Utah did not like Donald Trump. I mean, that's putting it mildly. They didn't like him at all. But still, he won by 20.5% over Joe Biden. They are going to vote Republican until they prove to me that they're not going to vote Republican, and I think they're going to vote Republican by decent margin, and that's why I think Lee does not have a lot to worry about regardless of what issues might emerge between now and then. They could have pictures of him performing devil worship and sacrifice or something, and I still think the man would probably win because he's the Republican nominee in an extremely Republican state, and I don't mean to diss Senator Lee. As far as I know, there's no scandal of any type associated with the man. He's just very, very conservative, and, well, that kind of plays well in that state, I'd say so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think he has a different brand of conservatism than they're used to, a lot of them. I think they're more comfortable with Mitt Romney, Orrin Hatch-type conservatism than they are Mike Lee conservatism, but that Republican brand in a place like Utah, it is a significant, you know, boost of your candidacy, to say the least. Well, let's try to hit another topic before Tom comes in. And something that stuck out to me was the South Carolina is putting together a bill, because websites are going up, and Catherine, you can probably tell us more about these kind of websites, that give information about, you know, reproductive choices, health care. I mean, frankly, it's really just health care information, but this South Carolina bill seeks to shut down those websites And this is really bizarre to me. Before we talk about the sites, is because this is kind of China-esque in how they treat Google, how you can limit, you know, information like this. I don't know how it would stand up to a First Amendment challenge if a law like this is passed, but let's kind of back up. And Catherine, if you know more about these websites, tell us.
Yeah, well, it's specifically about abortion. It's not about anything else. It's specifically the websites that help people who need abortions, where they can go. As it usually has, there's a couple of them. And they have the laws and I'm sorry. They have the laws and some of them even have information on how to schedule an abortion and, you know, what the requirements are as far as waiting periods or, you know, ultrasounds or whatever the requirements might be in the specific states. And I do not believe that this would stand up to First Amendment challenge, but, you know, that doesn't stop any of these state legislatures. They don't care if it's unconstitutional or if it's illegal. They'll still pass the law and try to enforce it. These are the kind of laws that are really meant for primary voters so they can stand up and say, see what I did? I tried to fight those, you know, abortionists, even if they know that it won't really be able to. I mean, how do they even enforce it? And what?
Yeah,
and
I
then
mean,
you.
There's a
I mean, it's a very complicated thing because then, how do you enforce it? How do you? And then who's liable? Are we talking about like the you know people who post the website or who host the website or? It's quite a thing to try to pass and enforce.
Yeah, Tim, if we were to right now Google on Google Maps the state of Utah, it would pull up casinos, it would pull up brothels, it would pull up marijuana distribution facilities, because all three of those things are legal in Nevada. They're not legal here. I can look at them, though, here if I wanted to. Don't spend any time looking at that. But I'm just saying, I could. So how is this any different than any other activity that's legal in one state and illegal in another, you being able to see that stuff?
Well, you know, I'm with Catherine on one thing. How would they even enforce such a law? How could they enforce it if, say, you downloaded for some of you techies out there, if you know what the Tor's browser is, you download that browser, and it can't even be traced by conventional means. How are they going to keep people from getting how are they going to regulate the Internet is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah.
How are they going to keep people from reading what they want to read? I mean, how are they going to get around the First Amendment, you know, with free speech and all such as that? The Internet don't magically stop it at a state boundary or something like that. How are they even going to do anything about it? These people are going out of their minds, like when Louisiana, you know, tried and failed, I might add, to make abortion punishable by death. Or out in Idaho, they're talking about their Republican Party platform won't make any exceptions for pregnant women whose lives become in danger. You know, why are they just pushing this further and further and further into just outright crazy territory? And I think that's what this bill is. How can they possibly outlaw websites people's personal computers?
I'm going to give you the how, but when I give you the how, you're going to see how ridiculous this is. Notice I mentioned China. And
yeah.
China has a lot of their own browsers where the state, I mean the national, I say the state, The government controls the companies that do the browsing. Google, of course, wants to get in there because there's a billion people. And so Google has done some things to their search in China that have been roundly criticized as a limit on free expression. Now, they do this because there's a billion people in China, and sometimes a lot of companies have done things that they know aren't right because there's a billion people in China, and they'll do it. Are they going to do it for the population of one state in America when a lot of other states with a whole lot more people are completely against this? I think the chances are so far to the right of the decimal point that, you know, any of these companies will do this. It's just totally unrealistic. So I think, Catherine, you were right that this is more of a show that they can talk about, I sponsored this, I voted for this, than this ever, A, passing, and B, being instituted in any kind of way. But it's just a foolishest waste of time. You know, Marco Rubio talked about a bill where I think a majority of the people don't think it's a waste of time. You want to talk about a waste of time, this bill that these South Carolina lawmakers are talking about is a total waste of time. But now
well,
I want to transition
one,
over.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, let's bring come back to it in a minute. But I want to welcome back into the kudzu vine for I don't know how many times for public policy polling. Welcome, Tom Jensen.
Hey, good to be with you all.
All right, Tom, good to have you back. Tom, I want to start off because we know there's so many good states and races that y'all polled, and we're going to get into that. But I want to start off with the overarching question about polling. You know, polling in 2016 was all a loss. Then there were some corrections made. In 2020, it was off in some states and not off in others. And so I'm sure more corrections are being made. And also, I think the pool of possible people being polled may have improved, but kind of give us, walk us through that about, like, what happened in 2020, what has been, what has either been corrected or if people changed since then, and what's it looking like as far as how to poll in 2022?
Sure. Well, I think that one thing that we definitely discovered over the last 5 or 6 years is that polling has been really, really good when Trump's not on the ballot, and it's had a really hard time when Trump has been on the ballot. So one reason it was so surprising that the polling was off in 2020 was that after it was off in 2016, 2017, 18, 19 were some of the more accurate years for polling that we've really ever seen. So I think there was a lot of assumption going into 2020 that after polling had done so well the previous 3 years that that things would continue to be good, and obviously that wasn't the case. So then the polling's off in 2020. And then everybody's like, okay, polling's dead. And then in 2021 and so far this year, polling's been really good again. So I think that there's something unique about Trump's presence on the ballot that really does throw polling off that I predict that this will be a pretty good year for polling without Trump on the ballot, and then we'll just have to see whether he's back in there in 2024 and what impact that has. But to talk a little more specifically about a few of the factors that I think are sort of affecting the accuracy of polling, one thing that I think threw things off in 2020 is when I look especially at our own polling in 2020, the polling that we did over the summer when everybody was sort of staying at home still came pretty close to the outcome of the election in most states. And it was actually our polling in September and October, much closer to the election, that was further off from the outcome. And that's sort of unusual. You would expect that the closer you get to the election, the more accurate the polling is. But what happened in 2020, that was a very unique dynamic, is that in the summer, pretty much everyone was still home, early days of COVID. Then in the fall, Republicans sort of started resuming their lives, and Democrats were still staying home. So when we would conduct a poll, Democrats were home to answer the poll, Republicans were out living their lives and not answering polls as much. And I think that is a big factor in why the polling ended up being so pro-Democratic, especially towards the end in 2020, when if you just looked at the polls in June, July, that sort of thing, they weren't very far off from what the outcome ended up being. So that's a dynamic that I think played a really big role in 2020 that I don't think is going to be as much of an issue or probably even an issue at all this time around, when most people have sort of gone relatively close back to living their lives the way that they did before the pandemic. So I'm pretty optimistic about how the polling is going to shake out this year. The polling that we did across the country last year and the polling that we've done across the country so far this year has pretty much ended up predicting the things that have happened. So, we had some people say, you know, are you going to make huge, major changes to how you do everything? And sometimes the answer to that is not to make huge, major changes to correct for what you did in 2020, because that might make you wrong in 2022, because 2022 is a different year. So we're actually pretty much doing things the same way that we did in 2020 the last couple of years, and we've had a lot of accuracy. So I think, you know, certainly the polling industry took a hit, and I get it, but I think that there were some unique circumstances then that maybe aren't still in play.
Yes, I mean, polling is a tool, and it's you know, if the tool didn't work one time, you just don't give up on the tool. It may not have been the best tool for the job at that time, and then it comes back around, and obviously we need it because what replaces it? Hard to know. I wanted to ask you kind of about a theory of, you know, why some of that happened and the voters that led to. A lot of people, you know, speculated that because people associate with polling with media, even though, you know, there's plenty of independent firms like yours that are not media, but they kind of, you know, relate it to media, that Trump, hardcore Trump base, that they just didn't answer polls. You know, because it was fake news and rigged and everything else, they didn't answer polls. And, of course, those folks dropped out and didn't, you know, participate, which I do find kind of ironic, because when Jordan Cleffer or Walter Masterson or all these other folks go to interview them at the rallies, they can't wait to talk, and they probably look a lot better in the poll anonymously than they do on the camera, but there's that theory. Polling may not be able to answer this, but I'm sure you've done research either through focus groups or read on interviews or what have you. How accurate is that thesis, and how much do you think it may have changed as well?
I think there is a little bit of truth to that, and I think that it's something that is probably a little cyclical. So what I think might have happened a little bit those last couple months in 2020 is the polls were bad for Trump. So at that point, Trump supporters aren't liking polls, and then they don't answer polls. We're not seeing that sort of thing so much right now because the polls are so bad for Biden. I think those same people who were like, "Yeah, you know, polls are all liberal, worthless junk, I'm not going to answer," in 2020, now they're getting bombarded with headlines talking about Biden's historically unpopular, blah, blah, blah. That's something more that they want to be a part of. We've really seen in our raw data this cycle compared to last cycle that Republicans and people who are supporters of Trump are much more excited about answering polls now than they were then. I think because it's just more fun to say that you disapprove of Biden than it was to have to sort of defend Trump and that sort of thing. And this is something that we kind of see just move cycle to cycle. I think that we did over the last 4 years see Democrats more energized to answer polls because they wanted to tell us how much they hated Trump. And now, to some extent, we have Republicans more excited to answer polls because they want to tell us how much they hate Biden.
Yes. Interesting analysis, and it does make sense. Now, I didn't ask about any of the state races, but I'm going to be kind to Tim and Catherine, and I'm going to pass it along. And if I think they've forgotten any states that we got to ask about, I'll pick that up. But I'm going to pass it to Tim.
Sounds good.
Hey, good evening, Tom. Isn't it kind of David to be kind to us tonight, buddy? So, look. I ain't believing I'm starting with the state of Maryland.
But a guy named Cox is the reason I'm doing that. And Governor Hogan said that the primary results in Maryland ensure that his party is going to be swept in November. Is he correct?
Well, I think he is correct, and I think what that speaks to more broadly, Tim, is this strategy that Democrats have been engaging in across the country to sort of mess around a little bit in some of these Republican primaries. The Democratic Governors Association decided to run a bunch of ads about Dan Cox during the primary, attacking him, you know, saying that he was so conservative and so supportive of Trump and that sort of thing. And as it turns out, that made Republican primary voters want to vote for him. And he not only won, he won by double digits. So there's a lot of hand-wringing that Democrats shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. But here's the reality. I mean, Larry Hogan won the governor's race as a Republican in Maryland in 2014 and in 2018, even when 2018 was a great year for Democrats nationally. And somebody who's very much sort of trying to carry on that Larry Hogan banner, Kelly Scholes, was running in the primary. Democrats had a very crowded primary field where you just weren't really sure who was going to advance or not. And it seemed like, given that Maryland had voted for a couple times in a row Republican for governor, given that Larry Hogan was very popular, given that this moderate woman was running to sort of try to carry on what he's been doing, I think if she'd won, you might have had something close to a toss-up race for governor. But instead now, because the Democratic Governors Association sort of held, sort of got the word out about who Dan Cox is, now he's the candidate, and he cannot win because he's too extreme. I mean, he's an insurrectionist. Maryland might vote for a super moderate sort of Republican, but they're not going to vote for a far-right sort of Republican like that. So in a year when Democrats are having to play defense for governor in Michigan, defense in Wisconsin, defense in Pennsylvania, defense in Minnesota, defense in Kansas, the list could go on and on. Now Democrats have pretty much won the Maryland governor's race in July, and that's one less race that they have to worry about over the next 4 months when there's so many races to worry about. So I think that Maryland showed that this is a very good strategy that Democrats have embarked on to mess around in these primaries. And, you know, we won't be talking about Maryland again, most likely this cycle, whereas if Kelly Scholes had won the nomination, you know, in October, we might have been talking about a toss-up race. And it's a whole lot cheaper to win the race in July than it is to have to be fighting it out to win it in October. So it's a lot of debate about this strategy, but I think in Maryland, certainly, it really worked out.
So Governor Hogan announced just in the last couple of days, as you know, that he is not going to support Mr. Cox. And speaking of strategy, what is he doing? Is he genuine about it? Is he setting himself up to do something on the national stage? What is Governor Hogan doing here?
Well, I do think he's setting himself up to do something on the national stage. I mean, it's pretty widely speculated that he wants to run for president. And I guess he's trying to establish himself as sort of like the sane Republican candidate. But you would think that what happened on Tuesday in his own state might show him that there's not much of a market for being the sane Republican candidate. If you can't even get your preferred successor within single digits in the primary in your own home state, I'm not sure how much your brand of Republicanism is going to appeal to Republicans in any other state. So I think Hogan's a genuine moderate. I think he's sincere that he's not going to vote for Dan Cox in the general, but I'm not clear what his angle is with this presidential thing, unless it's just to get famous. I mean, he'll get famous. He's the kind of candidate, if he really runs for president, the media is going to love him. That might get him to 3% in New Hampshire, but he'll get on TV a lot, and he'll probably, you know, be able to write a book and sell some copies and There's nothing the media loves more than the reasonable Republican. You get a lot of attention for being the reasonable Republican. the actual Republicans don't care a lick for you, but you'll get that sort of fawning media coverage. So I think that's where he's going.
Yeah, and speaking of New Hampshire, let's just go north and go there. Everyone on the Democratic side, I know I did, breathed a sigh of relief when Governor Sununu chose not to run for the U.S. Senate. Barring a national GOP wave, and I think that's a distinct possibility myself, but barring a GOP wave, is Maggie Hassan safe?
I don't think she's safe. I think she's probably narrowly favored. One thing that's interesting about New Hampshire is that obviously we know that Joe Biden has poor approval numbers everywhere, but New Hampshire is somewhere where we've seen his numbers sort of fall particularly acutely. Our most recent poll there, I think we found that he only had a 35% approval rating, 56% of voters disapproved of him, and this is a state that he won by 8 points. So to have a minus 21 approval rating in a state that you won by 8 points, he's down everywhere, but being down 29 points from his margin on Election Day 2020 there is pretty extreme, and I think that definitely means that the Senate race is going to be a tough one. New Hampshire's been a state that historically can have even more dramatic swings from election to election than most states do. One thing that was pretty wild the last time we had a new Democratic president is I think that Barack Obama had won New Hampshire by maybe even 16 points, but it was at least 12. It was something in that sort of range. And then in the U.S. Senate race in 2010, it was an open seat. Democrats felt like it was a really great opportunity. And then Kelly Ayotte won that open seat for the Senate by 23 points just a couple years after Democrats had won the presidential race by double digits in the state. So that shows the extent to which New Hampshire can have these really dramatic swings from election to election. So I think Hassan's the favorite, but I still think it could be close. But one thing that's kind of interesting from this New Hampshire poll that we did is Chris Sununu, who, as you noted, is so popular, won by over 30 points, won by over 30 points for reelection in 2020. So you would think that if he won by 30 in 2020, and Biden has only a 35% approval rating in the state, you'd think, oh, well, Sununu's definitely headed for winning by 30 again. And we actually found that when we polled the state recently, he was only up by 10. Certainly still favored for reelection, but a lot tighter than it was 2 years ago, even as Biden's so unpopular there. And I think something that speaks to that's been sort of unusual in our polling, especially over the last month or so, is that usually the worse the president's approval rating is, the worse his party does. And we've seen a situation over the last month where Biden's approval rating has gotten worse and worse, but overall prospects for Democrats for this year have gotten, if anything, a little bit better, and they certainly haven't got worse and worse. So we're seeing trends sort of work in different ways this cycle than we've necessarily been accustomed to in the past.
I think in traditional terms, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, the economy, people are going to vote their pocketbooks, you know, first. Right now, Biden has a 30% approval rating on his handling of the economy. You mentioned his overall approval rating, and I'm thinking in traditional terms, that usually means that the party in power in the White House is going to take a pasting. But yet you say Democrats have been gaining in the polling. Have you any idea what exactly is driving that? Is it some of these other issues that have entered the fray, like, I don't know, abortion, voting rights, gay rights, those sort of things, the Supreme Court decisions? Do you have any idea?
Yeah. I mean, definitely there's one overarching reason that things aren't as bad for Democrats as they should be, and that's that voters think Republicans are crazy. So they may be totally unhappy with Biden, but they think the alternative's crazy too. And I think the number one issue playing into that is, as you noted, the abortion issue. I think that people always just sort of took for granted that abortion rights were protected, and now that it's clear that they're not protected, that brings a lot of sort of well-educated suburban voters possibly back into the Democratic fold. Let me sort of talk about that specifically through the context of what happened in the Virginia governor's race last year and how that might be different now. Obviously, Virginia, you know, was starting to be seen more and more as sort of a solidly blue state. Democrats won it for president four times in a row between 2008 and 2020. It was never any closer than 6 points over that period of time. In 2020, Joe Biden won the state by double digits. And then all of a sudden, Republicans win the governor's race by a couple points last fall, which was quite a departure from what had been happening in the state in recent years. And the biggest reason, other than Democrats didn't turn out enough, the biggest reason that Republicans were able to win the governor's race in Virginia last year was because the places where Democrats had made huge gains among well-educated suburban voters because of the backlash against Trump, we're talking about the sorts of places where, you know, maybe Mitt Romney won, but then Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden won because Republican voters in those places were willing to vote for a Mitt Romney-style Republican, but they weren't willing to vote for a Donald Trump-style Republican. Those places, as soon as Trump was out of office, went back to voting Republican last year, and that's why Glenn Youngkin was able to win the governor's race. But abortion being taken away by the Supreme Court is the kind of thing that will take those well-educated suburban voters and put them right back to the Democrats, because they're like, okay, you know, we mostly just wanted to get rid of Trump, but now this sort of extremism is still here. Even though Trump's out of the picture, we may not be that enamored with Democrats, and the Democrats may want to raise our taxes more than we care for when we're really rich, but we'll take that over stuff like abortion getting taken away. So I think that in this year's elections, a lot of those kinds of voters who went away from the Democrats last year that allowed Republicans to win in Virginia, that allowed Republicans to make it so close to New Jersey, those kind of people may be back to voting for the Democrats this year because the Republicans have gone so crazy. In addition to the abortion issue being a really big one, I don't think that these ongoing hearings are doing anything to help the Republican cause either. I think that it's sort of a never-ending cavalcade of bad news for Republicans. So even though Democrats theoretically should be completely in terrible position for this fall, Republicans are doing a lot to sort of give away their natural advantage.
Well, I thank you for that analysis, and there's a bunch of states and stuff left, including this one, but I think I'm going to throw it over to Catherine to carry on. Catherine?
Well, geez, Tim, you stole my question, my big question, which was going to be about abortion and how that was going to, what kind of impact you thought that might have. Do you think it's going to have an impact on the election? I mean, do you think, like, I know people are troubled by it. Do you think by November they're still going to be upset about it? I hope so, but I'm just...
I do think that it's going to have an impact. Yeah, I do think it's going to have an impact. And I think the place where it's going to have the biggest impact is in terms of sort of what it does to voter engagement and motivation. What we have been finding throughout this election cycle up until about a month ago was that Republicans were much more excited to get out and vote this year than Democrats were. And a lot of the time, who's excited is what determines who wins in midterm elections. You know, you may not even necessarily have that many people who voted Democratic last time vote Republican this time around or that sort of thing. But what you often have in midterm elections is, let's just put it in Biden and Trump terms from 2020, maybe 60% of the people who voted for Biden in 2020 come out to vote, but 70% of the people who voted for Trump in 2020 come out to vote. Well, if that engagement level is so different, it doesn't even matter whether Republicans can win over anybody who didn't vote for them last time or not. They can win elections just because their side is so much more motivated. And that's what we were seeing as sort of the likely direction that things were headed in for most of the last year and a half. But ever since the abortion decision came down, now we're seeing that Democratic voters are about even with the Republicans in terms of their engagement level. And that totally changes the tenor of this year's election. What that means is that Republicans have to actually win over people who they didn't have vote for them last time around, instead of just winning because of the structural nature of who turns out to vote and who doesn't. And it's a very clear dividing line for when Republicans went from having a big enthusiasm advantage to things being pretty much equal. The dividing line was definitely when the abortion decision came down. So I think the big key to your point about whether this will last through November, Democrats have got to make sure that that anger about the direction that things are heading in remains for another 15 weeks. And if it does, it'll still probably be a good year for Republicans, but it may not be the sort of total bloodbath that it was headed for before the abortion decision came down.
Well, I just think that the other part of this is not just voter enthusiasm, but also the people who are one-issue voters, who some of these very dogmatic pro-life voters are, they're happy now. They got their thing. They're not going to be as motivated to vote and get engaged as they have been for the last, 40 years or whatever. So
I think you're right.
I was expecting those kind of results, but I'm relieved that it's actually happening. So thank you for that. That was really my main question. So I'm going to pass it back to David, who may pass it back to Tim for more on the states. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
Always appreciate having you on.
Yep. Yes. Well, Tom, now I get a chance to ask some specific state questions. And one that I found very interesting is the state of Michigan. Gretchen Whitmer, she had the kidnapping plot. Of course, the very high-profile protests with guns where the people were so upset they couldn't eat at Fuddruckers during the pandemic. And she came under all the fire from her detractors. But yet when the state as a whole gets polled, she is leading very comfortably. And I know y'all polled on the state as well. What have you found about what's going on there?
Yeah, we're usually finding her ahead by 7 or 8 points for reelection. Now, one thing I'll note is it's usually like 48 to 40, 47 to 41, that sort of thing. So she's not over 50%. I expect that the race is still going to end up being relatively close. But given that Biden has a 35% approval rating there, just like he does in New Hampshire, you definitely would not expect a combination of Biden having a 35% approval rating and Whitmer being up by 7 or 8 points. And one fascinating thing that happened in Michigan, and I think it again speaks to the way that Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot, is that there's a bunch of people running for governor on the Republican side, but the two most serious candidates who had raised the most money and seemed like they were going to be the top contenders both got kicked off the ballot because they didn't get enough valid signatures. So I think that sort of shows the weakness of the candidates Republicans are putting forth in a lot of these races, that you would end up with a situation where the two most serious candidates didn't even end up getting on the ballot. So you're almost definitely at that point going to end up having sort of a more second-tier Republican nominee put up against Whitmer. And then beyond that, one of the leading Republican candidates who did get on the ballot got arrested by the FBI last month for his role in the insurrection. So we were talking about in Maryland, the Republicans put up an insurrectionist, and that's certainly not going to fly in Maryland. Michigan's a much more middle-of-the-road kind of state, but I think it's a pretty safe bet that if Republicans put up an insurrectionist there, you're not going to necessarily have Gretchen Whitmer end up winning by 20 points, but I think she's going to win if they put up somebody who's been arrested this year against her. So I think what we see is sort of a common theme across a lot of these races is that, certainly Republicans theoretically should have a good chance, but if your good candidates get kicked off the ballot because they're sloppy about their signatures and the candidate who you're left over with got arrested by the FBI for what they did in the insurrection, that kind of throws away your chance. It's not like Gretchen Whitmer is beloved. We tend to find that voters are very evenly divided and their feelings about her. About half the state likes her and about half the state doesn't like her. But you can't beat someone with no one, and that's kind of what the Republicans are trying to do in a race like this. And there's a lot of races across the country. I think the Michigan example is somewhat extreme. There's a lot of races we could talk about across the country where Republicans are sort of shooting themselves in the foot by putting up terrible alternatives to these Democrats.
Yeah, I will say this. I agree that Gretchen Whitmer is probably going to pull this out because she's probably more popular than Roy Barnes in 2002. But in that case, he was beaten by no one because Sonny Perdue at that point in his career was certainly total unknown. But that's another race for another time, 20 years ago. Well, you also polled on Arizona. We know they have a really interesting Senate race where Mark Kelly's running for re-election. We know they have a governor's race where Doug Ducey's not running for re-election, and some of the candidates that are running in that state on the Republican side are outside the mainstream, to say the least. So tell us about both those races.
Yeah, Arizona's the kind of state that on paper really ought to go right back to the Republicans this year. Democrats won both the presidential race and the Senate race in the state by under a point in 2020. Democrats barely get across the finish line in those races in 2020. And, of course, this is supposed to be a really strong Republican political climate. And for most of the year, I've been saying that the political climate had moved about 7 or 8 points to the right of where it was in 2020. So you think about Democrats winning in Arizona by under a point. The political climate in the country moves 7 or 8 points to the right. You would think that in these races for governor and Senate that the Democrats would be pretty much done for. But in both of those races, Republicans are moving toward nominating the most extreme candidate. In the Senate race, Blake Masters has got the Trump seal of approval, and he has very extreme conservative views, and he's leading the race against, some opponents who have actually been elected to stuff before, and Masters is pretty much new on the scene, but he's in first place because of that Trump seal of approval. And then the governor's race, Carrie Lake, is a former television anchor. That's, her only real qualification for running for office. And for now, she's in the lead in the governor's race again because she has that sort of super extreme Trump seal of approval. And Arizona is the kind of place, in contrast to Maryland, where it's possible that if the Republicans nominate Blake Masters and Carrie Lake, they'll still win because of the state being so middle of the road and it being a strongly pro-Republican political climate. But it's very much keeping Democrats in the game, where maybe they shouldn't be in the game on paper, if Republicans go forth and nominate such extreme candidates. So, again, that theme just keeps coming up that it's like, on paper, this should be, really, really good for Republicans. But in all of these places, they are sort of either already have nominated weak candidates or they're moving towards nominating weak candidates. And then by contrast, you see the Democrats just raising scads and scads of money when you look at the Mark Kellys and Raphael Warnocks of the world. The Republicans are never going to be able to keep up on the fundraising front. So we'll see if Democrats end up pulling out a lot of wins in places where theoretically they shouldn't be able to this year.
Yes, and one final state and one final question for you. In Georgia, the polls we've seen have shown that, yes, ticket-splitting voters do exist. Brian Kemp has a, probably a single-digit lead. Raphael Warnock has a single-digit lead. And when you do the math, it shows that there are Kemp-Warnock voters. The polling you've seen or conducted,
What does it look like in those two races? Is it going to stay some ticket splitters, or are people going to break each way and maybe change that race?
Well, you know, I don't think there are going to be many ticket splitters, but if you start both races off at 50-50 and 2% of the Warnock voters vote for Kemp and 2% of the because that's the sort of ticket splitting we're seeing, as you say, then you could easily end up in a world where Warnock wins 51-49 and Kemp wins 51-49. So it doesn't take a whole lot of people sort of matching that unusual trend to get you to the point where you could end up with a split decision in those races. But I think the main bottom line with both of those races is I expect them both to be very close to the end. I'll be surprised when it gets to be November 7th, election eve, or let's say that we talked on November 6th, the Sunday before the election. If either of those races is off the board as a competitive race, I would be quite surprised.
Yes. Well, before I let you go, Tim, Catherine, it seems like we've got our guest booked for November 6th. Tom volunteered. Tag, he's it. But I'll just – but in all seriousness, we do want to have you back before the election for sure. But go ahead and tell our listeners, like, if they want to follow you on social media, look at the website where you'll post some of your polls. I mean, we know a lot of your polls are private, but some are released to the public, where folks can, you know, see all that.
Yeah, probably the best place to see stuff that does get released is our Twitter account, which is at PPP Polls, and then our website is.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight and sharing all that good information. Keep up on with the polling, and then, like I said, we will get you back before the election, not necessarily the Sunday before, but who knows, and then we'll get some more great data from you.
Okay. It's always really great talking to all of you. I appreciate everything the three of you do.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you,
we love
you as well.
On.
Yeah. Hey.
Yeah. That was Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling, and we got just a minute or two left. And, Catherine, you were going to make a point about the websites in South Carolina, so I obviously want to start off by letting you make that point.
Well, I just want to say that even though we think that this is unconstitutional and how are they going to enforce it and all that, it still has an impact because it makes people frightened that if they do something, they're going to get in trouble. So even though we don't know how they would enforce it or all of that, it still has an impact and it still hurts the people who need the services. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're right that somebody, if it was hosted in the site, somebody might be fearful of that, although you can host things anywhere
nowadays. No, I'm talking about
nowadays. And then if
I'm
somebody
talking about
was
someone
producing the content inside. What?
No, that's not the people I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a person who's pregnant who is looking for services in South Carolina, being afraid to look on the web, on the internet, for fear that they're going to be tracked down and somehow, you know, penalized for it. So it adds further stress to a person who's already very concerned about their health and what their next steps are. So that's the kind of fear that I'm talking about.
Yes, and you know, kind of, I'm wondering, and it'll take a while to get this kind of data, but if we end up seeing because of this law, you know, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, there's going to be less abortions, therefore pregnancies are going to go up and live births are going to go up and the population, you know, is going to rise, you know, to some point. You know, people aren't going to start having, you know, 10 kids in a family, I don't think anytime soon, on a regular frequency without that. But I think actually what may happen is you're going to have less, you know, unplanned pregnancies because people may have less sex. I mean, just to be honest about it. And therefore, you may have a drop in the pregnancy rate in a lot of places. And that's going to be a very much an unintended consequence of some of these Republican lawmakers who seem to, you know, like the idea of, you know, people having more children, but they're just missing the targets. They're just not understanding, you know, demographics and who's wanting what and when. So I think that's going to be like a discussion we have with, you know, Ron Hetrick 5 years from now. We have data, not, you know, 5 weeks from now to unfold. Well, guys, it seems like I don't think we have time to get into another topic. Some of the things we have planned may keep anyway till next week, and who knows in the next 7 days what's going to come up in the world of politics for us to discuss. So until then, been the Kudzu Vine. Good night,
guys. Good night, y'all.
Hi, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force?